Hello and welcome to Talk To Me with me, Shane Maloney, a show where I seek out interesting and accomplished people who have thought-provoking stories to tell. My guest today is Natalie Wilkie. She's an organisational development and innovation consultant, as well as a qualified psychotherapist and counsellor. Natalie has had a varied and interesting career, starting out in the world of marketing and advertising, working with some of the biggest brand names that there are. She was at the leading edge of the digital revolution in marketing in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and was involved in some of the earliest marketing campaigns on Facebook. She has studied topics as disparate as acting and astronomy. But it was Natalie's experiences in counselling and therapy that took her in a new direction, leading her to obtain an MA in psychotherapy and counselling. A change in lifestyle and location led Natalie to a role with the UK Meteorological Office as an organisational development consultant, which gave her the opportunity to meld her previous experiences and training to develop a people-focused approach to innovation in organisations. I discuss with Natalie how she wove these strands of her life and career together, and we get into the impacts of traumas, be they big or small, the role shame plays in perpetuating negative cycles, and how mental health issues are regarded today. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Natalie as much as I did. So, Natalie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I'm going to kick off with this. When I hear the word trauma, I think of it as a consequence of a major life event. You know, we think of soldiers returning from war zones. We think about people who've been involved in major traffic accidents or aviation accidents or things like that. But I'm starting to learn that's not necessarily the case. There's like low-level trauma that we all kind of experience in everyday life. And I think we have a habit of kind of disregarding that, like it's not really a thing. But I'm starting to learn that's not the case.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I think, put it this way, I don't know anybody that hasn't experienced trauma that I have met. So from my point of view, it's kind of, you know, it is on a spectrum. There's lots of different types of trauma. And I think that, you know, quite often we can have small things that are traumatic. And so what tends to happen is, particularly say you've got a child who is getting low level trauma a lot, then that can be equally as damaging, from what I can see, as people who have had huge, big traumas of one incident or chronic, you know, major chronic abuse or something like that. So for me, you know, it's really important to, when I get clients coming to me and sort of saying, well, I've had this great life and why do I feel like this? You know, they don't understand. But then when you actually work with them, you can see that they've had these kind of ongoing chronic sort of small things, you know, and as parents, you know, parents are human beings, so they're gonna screw up, they're gonna make mistakes.
There's no user manuals. Yeah,
no, absolutely. And so, you know, so if we look at a person's history, so my theoretical background is very based around you know, the quite traditional psychotherapy. So looking back at somebody's history, what they've experienced, their attachment to people and their connections to people when they were very young. And then what they, if they got everything they needed, and then it, you know, follows through. And so when I look back at these, you know, people's or children's sort of histories and look at their, you know, their very young period, you can quite often see these little things. And, you know, parents, you can get probably small traumas, like, you know, a parent loses their temper and snaps at you one time. You know, that's a trauma, a small one, maybe, depending on how major that, you know, aggression was. But it is a trauma.
A trauma to the child now. Yeah, you're
the
child on the receiving end. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, and I expect most parents have snapped at their children.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, I suppose, you know, the people that I might see in a therapeutic situation might have much more consistent and repetitive mistakes by parents. Let's just put it that way. You know, and that will then add up to a sometimes quite chronic mental health issue.
Yeah.
You know, and I've, you know, I do occasionally you get people saying, oh, I've had this my childhood was perfect. And I always think, okay, you know, that always rings alarm bells for me.
Yeah, it's a red flag,
because I just
yeah.
kind of think, you know, it might, you know, it might have been a good childhood. Yeah, of course, you know, in the scheme of things. But I doubt many people could say that their childhood was perfect and that their parents were perfect.
No.
So,
and I think people as well have a habit of going, I don't know, there's almost like a guilt around this. It's like, but there's people much worse than me. So therefore my experience get completely disregarded because there's somebody worse. And I'm like, well, that's not really necessarily the case. It's like, you know, your experiences are your experiences, and that's what's shaped you.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I have to say it's all relative. And I actually think that statement, people had it worse than me. I hear that from quite seriously abused people, mm-hmm. you know, and for me, it's a bit of a defense.
Yeah.
So there's some work I'm doing an awful lot of at the moment, and I'm exploring more. I've done a lot of work like this for a long time, but I'm exploring it more in a very kind of more visual way at the moment with, in my organizational work and in therapeutic work, which is around parts. And that we have this kind of core sense of ourself that we're born with, okay, that we have to discover and we have to explore and find. And that is perhaps the more compassionate, central kind of steady, rational part, okay? So as an adult, you might know that you've got that part. So when you're panicking about something, you'll get this part coming in, going, okay, you know, why don't you just take a breath, just walk out, and, you know, and giving you that kind of good advice, yeah, which may not happen for everyone. Then you have the painful parts that you've experienced. So like the little traumas, the big traumas, the repetitive chronic things that you've experienced. And those can go on through your whole life. You know, you could have a recent bereavement that could be part of these painful parts. And those parts, you know, I work with clients and I get them to name them, you know, what are these parts and who are they and what do you want to call them? So it could be like a little part or a part that lost their parent or, you know, that kind of thing. And that's where a lot of the painful emotions are. But in the middle, we have what in some of the work I've been doing recently is called protectors. And protectors are the things that stop us getting to those parts, the painful parts.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Well, it does.
You're on the right track.
Yes, absolutely. So makes sense
to
me.
We've all got them. Yeah, we've all got these protectors. I have them. I binge watch Netflix. I do a lot of social media stuff. I get very busy, you know. And though those things could be seen as, oh, well, that's okay. Everyone does that, you know, it's fine. But if it's blocking me from my painful parts, then it's, you know, there's a balance, isn't there? You know,
there is. And
we need that balance.
I always find as well, you know, somebody goes, you know, person A kind of deals with, or, you know, their protector is they perhaps go and drink too much alcohol, right? That's one way.
Absolutely.
Of doing it,
okay? Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
But then another person will run 10 marathons a year. And socially, socially we kind of go, person A really shouldn't be drinking too much. That's bad for him or her.
Yeah.
But person B is just exercising and that's good for you. And I'm like, well, not necessarily, because what's person B hiding or running away from almost quite literally with all this running? And sometimes we have social labels on things as good and bad. And I'm like, well, it depends on why you're doing them. What's driving you to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's when you sit down with somebody and you actually, and it's an exercise that, you know, we can all do, is sit down and look at those protectors and what we use. And it's quite amazing, you know, what we use. And sometimes they can be healthy things, like you say, exercise. But sometimes that exercise can turn into literally running away from something, you know, and that's when it can become extreme.
Yeah.
Or So alcohol, drugs, they're very quick, easy things. You know, they don't take a lot of work. They're kind of help people socially and help in other ways, you know. So they're kind of like slam, very quick, easy things to do. And then you've got these other things that are kind of, we all use food, exercise, being busy, distraction, any kind of distraction.
I love the being busy one. You know, you say to somebody, how are you? And you go, oh, I'm really busy. And I would never think of anything of that. Now that I kind of, I've read a bit more and I've learned a bit more and I've kind of gone through the corporate cycle with some big companies and busyness is a badge of honor type of thing. And I've really kind of sat back and gone, saying you're busy is not like, okay, if you're achieving, you know, if you're getting stuff done, that's one thing. But how are you? I'm busy. That's not the correct answer to that question. I asked you, how are you? You know?
Yeah, I know. And I think we've got a really big cultural thing of being busy as well. Yeah. It's kind of in organizations, we kind of prize it, don't we?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'm busy, so therefore I'm really important.
Correct.
I must be important.
Correct.
And it connects to our identity and our status. So, yeah. So, but coming back to the statement of, well, they've got it worse than me, I think I see that as a protector.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of protector part in some therapies. You might call it a defense. And it's kind of like, I can't look at that because they've got it worse than me, you know?
Okay.
And it's quite a good one.
It's like denying yourself permission to go and look at it.
Yeah,
like it's vain, I think so. Vain in some way, or it's like, you know, but these people are much worse than me. Why should I spend time on this?
Yeah, and also it links in to a part that a lot of us have, which is a critical part that is going, well, you don't deserve to get help anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're introducing shame into the whole situation. And again, like, I'm learning more and more. I mean, it's incredible. You start to scratch the surface around shame and the role that shame plays in mental illness in general and not people not seeking help because of shame. And it's almost like it's the huge catalyst that keeps everything running in the background in a negative sense.
Yeah, it really is. It's kind of, I was talking about this yesterday, literally in a workshop, and how, you know, in workplaces, we expect people to come in and I've literally heard it by people, leave your baggage at the door, you know, and for some people, that's easy. Yeah. But for others, it isn't. And part of my organizational work is about encouraging more feelings into the workplace, that in order for us to be human beings and not robots in the workplace, we have to have feelings and we have to be able to share them and experience them. You know, it's like, we talk about in workplace innovation, you know, Rosemary and Peter often talk about this sense of, bringing yourself to work. Now, how are you bringing yourself to work if you're leaving any emotional content at the door?
Yeah, leave the bit of you that's human at the door and just come in here and be productive.
Yeah. And I think there's a real shame around people having feelings and emotions at work, and, you know, going back to what you were saying, this, and it's
unless it's
really
anger, because where I've been angry, he's just passionate, really.
No, he's like a real bully and really aggressive, but he's just passionate.
Yeah.
I know, and that's an interesting one because for me, you know, there's this all talk, isn't there, a lot about resilience and things like that at the moment. And people often see resilience as being, you don't have feelings, you're really able to just keep going in this robotic manner. And actually, I see it as the opposite. I think people who are more in touch with their feelings, more able to experience their feelings as and when, are less likely to have a big explosion or break down, or be a bully at work, or, you know, because they're much more in touch with what's going on for them.
Yeah, they're functioning as a human being in the workplace as opposed to some, as you said, some sort of robot.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And we do that mindful. I don't know if you've seen the mindful and survival things that we've done, where through the emotional intelligence work that I do, there's a sense of if somebody is really losing it and is aggressive and controlling and micromanaging and all those things, that they're actually in survival state. So their trauma, their previous stuff is being triggered, but on a kind of constant basis.
So here's one. This is a big question. So it's I can't expect you to answer it in its entirety, but we'll touch on it anyway. So from what we've said so far, we've understood that trauma is more commonplace than we're led to believe. It can be from childhood, from almost pre-memory, if you will, but it does some part of your body remembers, all the way through being an adult, having whatever traumas that you're experiencing. So if you recognize that, then how do you process that trauma? How do you work? So you kind of go, okay, there's this thing that I didn't know that was in my life and it's now there. So what do I do about it?
There's loads of ways. And so in the work that I particularly do, I do EMDR as part of my work. So I do talking therapy.
EMDR is?
Eye movement desensitization reprocessing.
Okay.
So it's a very common, they use it in the NHS. It's quite a recognized form of trauma support and help you to process the traumas. So basically, it sounds a bit exotic,
right, okay.
But it's very effective, really effective. And it's basically to do with the left and the right sides of your brain. And there's not an absolute concrete reason why it works, but it's to do with you bilateral stimulate. So if I'm doing stuff in person, I might be kind of getting somebody to follow my fingers and their eyes will move to either direction. If I'm doing it online or in, you know, at the moment in COVID, I can't go as close to people. So I do like tapping on either side, but like, or stamping or tapping on arms. And it seems to process, you focus on a particular trauma and then you can go back and process on it. And there's a whole process of doing this. And I've literally seen amazing results with it, where someone has gone from, say, a disturbance level of 8 or 9 out of 10 down to a 2 in 4 sessions, you know. And this can be very chronic stuff. It doesn't have to be a kind of one-off, you know. But yeah, it's, you know, and I'm sure people have done it in a lot less sessions as well. So it's really effective. But what it does do is it cuts through a lot of the protectors. So a lot of the things that pop up and stop us.
It is actually almost just quite like distraction. It is like, it's almost like look over here type of thing, while you then kind of treat the person in a way, you kind of distract the protector.
Well, there's some EMDR people that actually say that it's for people that are really, struggling with the EMDR because it's quite intense, because you do sometimes go back through that process, that you would do as much as you can, you know, to distract them. So you'd be tapping, you'd be doing lots of different things to almost get them through that processing. So, but I mean, that's just one method.
One of many methods, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, talking therapy, it takes a long time, but that can certainly support shame if you have the right therapist that comes from trauma. And it can, over a long period of time, help to process the trauma too. You know, for some people, just talking about what happened to them, if they can remember it. But then things like the early stuff, like you're saying, the pre-verbal stuff, that is very much in the body. So there's lots of types of therapy that involve the body. I personally myself did lots of voice and movement therapy for a long time, which was about vocal expression, but in relation to emotion, lots of body movement sort of work, like drama-y type
right,
stuff.
Okay.
And that, I found that amazing too. So it's, I think you, you know, from my point of view, you kind of, it's good to mix and match, not all at the same time, but one after the other to try and get different techniques. And
I'm just checking something here because I'm listening to a book at the moment and I want to get the body keeps the score.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that's where some of the stuff I was saying earlier about this kind of like pre-verbal and the, some of the work that had been done with monkeys and things like that about, you know, how the mother bonded with the baby had such an impact. Okay. And that's just in monkeys, but you start to kind of join the dots and you're a little bit like, it's so important, like the early years, you know, you can kind of understand when something happens to you and you remember it and you might carry that with you. Actually, it turns out that, you know, if you've had a tough time before you were the age of two, like you're in a bad spot to start with. Like you're predisposed to so many different mental health problems potentially that could be coming down the line.
Yeah. Well, when I worked early in my career, I worked in a secure institution doing psychotherapy, and I had this amazing supervisor, and she was very old school, kind of Kleinian psychoanalytic, you know, very old school sort of, you know, which was amazing experience to learn from her. But with the people who were in the institution, you know, basically a prison, she would work with them and she would work with us as our supervisor in a very Kleinian, very early stage way. So up to one year. And it would be a lot of really early stuff around fantasy and, you know, lots of things around that, which is quite, is if you look into Kleinian, it's quite heavy and not something that is easy to kind of grasp, but it was quite interesting. She was all about that early stuff and what you're describing. But there's also neurological stuff now kind of backing that up, which is the book, you know, like the book you're reading.
Yeah. I was fascinated by things, and I'm going to get this completely wrong, but I'll summarize it best as I can anyway, about how you're treated, and we say, for example, the bond you might have with your mother or parents, you can get receptors in the brain which then get coated with a certain type of chemical which can then make you more or less likely to react to, you know, you might take a blood sample and you look at the blood sample and you go, well, this particular hormone is as you would expect, it is a normal level. But because of what's happened to the child here, the receptor doesn't work properly anymore. It's been altered, yeah. It's been changed. And stuff like that just blows my mind. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I'm not very good at remembering all the stuff, you know, that I did in training in regards to that kind of more scientific stuff, but there's so much now. And there's a book that you might be interested in. I've got to remember what it's called. I remember it, but it summarizes a lot of this neurobiology stuff. And it was one of our books that we had to read. I think it's Why Love Matters. Why Love Matters. That's it. And it was, I can't remember the author, but that was really about very early, even pre-birth as well. So cortisol and things like that in the mother, the stress of the mother before birth, you know, and how that impacts the cortisol levels in the child, and then that has an impact on their body and their brain. And yeah, so yeah, that's fascinating.
It's crazy stuff. So you mentioned there about training. Let's do a little bit of segue here and let's talk about your career and how you've arrived at where you've arrived at today. What was Natalie's journey? Because from what I've seen on the website, you've got a bit of a hybrid career, shall we say,
which
I think puts you in a really great position to do the sort of work you're doing right now. But tell us about that. What was Natalie's journey like to today?
Yeah. So it's quite a mixed up thing, really. So
most people are, by the way, when you speak to people, people have this idea of a career path that you kind of do A, B, C and D. And the reality is nowhere like that.
I know. Well, do you know what? It's kind of, it was really useful for me to go through what I did, because I now, you see my clients and things going, oh yeah, but I've got to stick to what I'm doing, and you know, and my parents want me to do it, and I'm like, well, do you want to do it really, you know? So it's good in that respect. So I started out in marketing. I was working in London in advertising and marketing agencies, and I did that for about 16 17 years in total. You know, I did a lot of freelance work. So I worked in most companies in London during those 16, 17 years, and just was doing, you know, like project management, account management. So working with clients and, you know, working with teams. And I was doing a lot of digital work quite early on. So I was doing very early on, I started doing bits of coding and stuff. Okay. And then during the years, I focused more on digital, although I didn't end up being a coder, but it was kind of something that I really enjoyed. So quite early on, I was doing really big, when Facebook first came out, we were doing campaigns on Facebook and things for, I worked for a few big, some of my clients were like film companies and things. So I did that, but I found it so hard. And at some point during that time, I think I'm the type of person that I can't do one full-time thing, because I'm quite conscientious. I worry about how I'm doing on it. And so I would literally be working. It would be consuming me. And it was really stressful work and quite tricky. So I decided at one point, I was working with America a lot because we were doing a lot of digital work and they had programmers over there. And I was working in the UK, so I was up really late every night. And I think I just got burnt out. And I was like, okay, no more. So I decided from then on that I would do part-time. And that was not, you know, it was probably about 5 or 6 years into my career that I decided that. I was just like, I can't do this full-time. And then I started working part-time. And then I decided to do different training, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was having therapy for my own stuff. And then, I was just exploring it with my therapist, all these things. And so I did all these short courses. So I did like astronomy, because I'd always been interested in astronomy. So I did astronomy course with the Open University. I did acting courses. I did, you know, all these little things in this spare, okay, you know, day a week. And one of them was therapy. And then after that, I did this sort of short certificate in skills at Westminster Pastoral Foundation, I think it was, WPF in London. And I really enjoyed it. But I couldn't afford to do the course that I wanted to do next, because the place I wanted to go, it was quite expensive. And so I thought, okay. So I just carried on doing freelancing and doing what I was doing and carried on with some of those other things as kind of hobbies and stuff. And ended up doing mentoring for Turning Point in Brixton, which was an amazing experience as well, which I love, just working with people who were coming off alcohol and drugs and helping them, you know, getting back into life. And it was partly because I needed volunteering experience, but also it was something that was, you know, I just loved doing. And after that, I then eventually saved up enough money to do my course, which was really expensive. And did that was at Regent's College at the time. It's now Regent's University. And I did my MA in psychotherapy and counselling. But I was still doing all my freelance stuff.
While doing an MA.
Work while doing that. Yeah, I mean, you know, while I was doing my course. So I would literally be, I'd have to do placements during the week and I would be doing my a day worth of stuff. And I would then be working as well, but I had to, because I couldn't afford it otherwise. And it was, yeah, you know, and I loved it. I just absolutely loved doing this, you know, therapy work. But again, I knew I couldn't do it full time, you know, because I knew it would just be too much for me. Like, you know, I try and give, I hope I do, some may disagree, but I try and give what I can, as much as I can, to my clients and my work. And I just couldn't do anything like that full time. It's very intense.
Yeah, you've got to make sure there's something left for yourself and your family when the working day is over.
Yeah. And so then I ended up having my first child and ended up coming down to Devon. And we were, and I worked at the Met Office for a long time. And interestingly with that, it kind of really brought together the therapy skills and the skills I got from marketing and business and creativity work. And that kind of was just perfect. It was just kind of like, I was working a lot with culture and I was working with innovation. That's how I started. And then it expanded into, and at the end I was working on the big sort of transformation program.
So what was your role in the Met Office? Because kind of going from an MA in psychotherapy to the Met Office is a bit of a kind of, okay, how does that add up?
Yeah. It was basically we came down here and I needed to get a job and I saw this job and I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. And it was part-time, or they would allow me to do it part-time. So I was, and it was a contract. So it was to begin with. So it was easy, you know, it was ideal. So I kind of fell into it actually, but I really loved it. And it was, I suppose I kind of moved more into the human resources side that I hadn't really been in before. I mean, I've been a leader of a team. I was account director. So I was managing big teams, but I wasn't working on that side of things in HR. But the innovation thing, they wanted somebody originally, the original job was about working out an innovation program, taking on the innovation staff across the Met Office and trying to promote innovation across the Met Office. So it really played into what I've been doing from a marketing perspective as well. So this is why it was quite interesting. And I came from creative agencies. So everything we were doing was innovation. And a lot of the stuff that we were doing on digital in those agencies was really cutting edge stuff because it was really early when we started doing it. So it was, I think that those elements came in, you know, that creativity, the innovation and the marketing, and then combined with me knowing people and being able to suss people out, just worked really well.
Understanding how people work underneath the hood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. And and then I worked there and that role developed. It just developed over the 5 or so years I was there, really. And I became permanent there. To begin with, I was thinking about it the other day, and we did so much around building innovation, getting people. It wasn't about somebody just being innovative. It was about what conditions do you need for people to be innovative? What do you need around them? You know, what help, what support, what working practices, all those kind of things. And then that led to me doing more cultural work, working around leadership, working with leaders, and then the emotional intelligence staff, which obviously suits me down to the ground because, you know, so I, there was a company that we were working with at the Met Office, who at the time are called JCA Global, and they do profiling for like emotional intelligence. And so I contacted them and I was working with them closely on these programs, and then I did their training. So it just, you know, kind of, I fell into it. But what I did do was I always followed my kind of interests. You know, I think the experience of being in this tough world of marketing and advertising just really taught me that you've got to follow, I don't know, go with your gut instinct, you know.
Yeah.
And then I fell into things that I loved. So that was good.
Yeah.
Lucky.
I suppose, and I would say as well that you reach for them though. You put the effort in. I mean, there's financially it was a challenge, but you found ways to make it work. You found ways to make it work.
Yeah. And that's one of my things is I literally believe that, you know, we can all do anything if we really try.
If you really push your shoulder
to the wheel. If we really want it, we can really make it happen.
So here's one for you. Here's a question that I like to ask, and I phrase this in a certain way. What would be the short question would be, what's your favorite personal failure, right? And the reason I ask that is what you normally find is that something that you regard as a failure today can be a blessing later on in life. So now from where you're standing looking back, what's your favorite apparent failure? Because, I mean, we've all gone through it. I've been in situations where it's like, oh my God, I've lost a job, or I've, you know, this, that, the other. And actually now when you look back, you go, oh my God, it was totally the right thing to happen. Or the reason I couldn't make that work was because I just wasn't supposed to. I was the wrong person for that. You know, whatever way you want to phrase it, like, oh, it's the universe telling you, will you stop trying to do this? It's not right for you.
You know what? So there's so many of those.
Yeah.
And I don't know which one to choose.
Yeah.
Because I've, you know, if I look back, I failed a lot. And, you know, those things that you often get where you go, oh my God, that's so embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, and you kind of think about it and it kind of makes you cringe. You know, I quite often now do EMDR on some of those things, going back to that.
Okay.
Because I'm just like, oh my God, how did I ever do that? But yeah. But interestingly, I don't know how to choose, but there's one that is much more personal, I suppose, actually, and this is really interesting. So we've been trying to have a baby for a long time and hadn't been able to. I was a bit older, you know, I wasn't really old, but I was a bit older, and we were struggling. And I was in a job. I'd moved from a small agency to a big agency, and I really was struggling with it. Being in a small agency always suited me because I could just do everything, and I could really interact with people. But moving to this very big agency, I couldn't. The etiquette I struggled with, in the sense of everyone being quite siloed, you know, people were quite in sort of segments of their job. And I think I overstepped the mark quite a lot and stood on a few people's toes. And also I was kind of like, I want to make things happen and I will push forward. And I think that that also got me into a few problems with people as well. I think people struggled with me, quite frankly.
Right. Okay.
So I was in this job anyway, unsurprisingly, and we were also, you know, trying to get pregnant. And about a year in, I got made redundant, and I kind of, it was interesting, you know, I kind of knew that I was going to get made redundant.
Okay.
But actually, by the point that I hadn't heard anything for ages. So I was thinking, oh, I might not be getting made redundant. But then all of a sudden I was. So it wasn't really a surprise in many ways, but also it kind of was. And it was really hard for me because I'd never been made redundant from anything before. And, you know, and I thought I was doing really well. You know, I was thinking, because, you know, they do those scoring things. Have you ever done those? When you get made redundant and they score you.
Okay, I haven't been through that. I've been through many scoring exercises in the various companies that I've worked for, but not as I went out the door. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, they're saying that you're not quite as good as other people.
Okay.
You know.
It's the paperwork to prove why you're going out the door, essentially, yeah?
Absolutely. Right, okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. But I actually think that I had ruffled some feathers. So actually, I shouldn't have been that surprised by that, because I think I would have been marked low by certain people. So anyway, so I got made redundant and I was like, oh God, what do I do? You know, I was doing... Was I doing my course? I can't remember where I was with that. I think I was still doing my course. So yeah, I was still training. And then I ended up getting pregnant in 2 months. And we've been trying for like ages. And I stopped work. I had a few months off because I got redundancy money. And I got pregnant. And it was really weird. And that pregnancy remained, and I went on to have my daughter. But so that was kind of quite an obvious thing, that there was something in the universe that was not going right. And then I stopped, and then I got pregnant. But also, it really made the difference of, I then went and worked in a small agency and just loved it and loved the people, advertising agency. And they were like, they knew I was pregnant. I was freelancing. And they said, okay, freelance up until you're due. And, you know, and I did that, and I left, and they gave me loads of lovely presents when my daughter was born. And it was just a lovely experience, you know. So I was back to feeling confident again after having that quite tricky experience.
There's a whole, I mean, you're touching on the edge there. There's a whole thing around when to walk away. Because it's, you know, where kind of culture is that, you know, winners don't quit and all of this type of thing. And it's like, well, if you want to make room for something new and good in your life, you're going to have to let something go, because most of our lives are pretty jam-packed as it is. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know, it's like pruning a tree or something like that. You've got to cut back on certain things to go the next step and for other things to grow. Now, in your particular case there, they kind of did some forced pruning. But it's an interesting thing that, you know, I've come across in my life, and that I think about. It's like, how are you really seeing the situation for what it is, and how to make decisions based off of that? Mm. I mean, is that some of the work that you would do with leaders and things like that, about being in touch with themselves, their emotions, and making decisions?
Mm. Absolutely. And, you know, I've done coaching and stuff for a while now in organizations, and sometimes the conversations are, you don't want to do this job, do you? and it's like, no, I don't, you know. So what are you going to do? How are you going to do this? And they're kind of going on and on and on, and it's just like, and they're miserable,
yeah,
you know. And so sometimes it does, you know, well, actually not that uncommon that will be an outcome for somebody, and that we will be looking at their plan to move on rather than staying.
Yeah.
But they're not helping the company if they're feeling that way either. So, no. You know.
No, I always remember why I started working for a large corporate organization in London, and I mean, in general, it was a good experience. Yeah, I learned a lot there. It was great to have on my CV. I met some great people. I had some great experiences. But I think, similar to you, after about 3 years or 2.5 years, I was a bit like, I don't think this really is the right place for me. But I do remember one day being on the platform of Charing Cross Station. I remember seeing this guy who just looked absolutely exhausted. And it wasn't because he just had a tough couple of days or whatever. He was exhausted because he'd been doing the commuting to London thing and the corporate thing for 30 years or whatever. And you could just see it all over him. And I remember that moment saying to myself, okay, I'm making a promise to myself, I'm not going to be that guy. It works for some people. But there and then I was just like, that's my future potentially, and it's not what I want. And to have the courage of your convictions to kind of go, okay, now I need to press the button on that and make a plan. And that's hard, you know, particularly if you've got mortgage and kids and wife and all of that carry on. So,
but I think there's ways to do it. You know, I always like, you know, like you say, whenever I've taken a risk. So, you know, I left one of my jobs in the middle of the dot-com. Well, it burst literally after I just left. So I was like, okay, this was very early on in my career. I was going to leave. I was going to go freelancing, and I was going to earn more money because I was freelancing, and my skills were in high demand. And then the dot-com burst.
The market
imploded. And I managed to get a few months of freelance work back at the job that I just left. But then I had nothing. And I also had some really difficult life stuff coming on as well. And I ended up freelancing, doing temp work. And I worked in these amazing companies that I never would have worked in before, with amazing people, met all these kind of people I never would have met had an entirely different experience. And actually, that was just what I needed in at the time for the events that also occurred in my personal life. So again, it was almost like the universe was going, you need to do this, you know. But I found a way. Okay, I wasn't earning the money I needed, but I don't know how I did it, but I found a way to get through that time and reevaluate and sort things out. And I think you do. I think people do.
So you've mentioned a word that I spend a lot of time, partly because of my engineering background and the work that I do. It's a thing we have to deal with all the time. But from a personal point of view, it's something I look at and I've kind of reframed a bit, and that's risk. You know, how do you characterize, analyze, and then process risk? Because we're not really very good at it. We are to some extent, but I think in the modern world we can over-evaluate and overstate certain things that are risks. It's like that guy who's working in a company for 30 years and you're coaching him and you're going, you're miserable, you don't want to be here. He's obviously looking at that and going, well, it's too big a risk to move. It's too big a risk to leave.
Yeah.
I can't do it. So, I don't know, let's kick that around for a little bit. So how does Natalie kind of look at risk and evaluate risk and kind of go, that's too risky, I'm not going to do it, or yeah, maybe.
I think, well, if I do it, it might be different to other people, but if I'm helping other people with it, I get them to explore the kind of what would it be like not to do it.
Okay. Yeah.
So that is a big one, I think, because I think generally pretty much everybody I've ever known who has taken that kind of risk I'm not talking about crazy risks where they literally put their whole selves and their families on the breadline. You know, I'm talking about measured risk. And I would quite often work with someone on what plan they could do. So what could they do? So it might be that they need to apply for another job and just look at what's out there, you know, get them thinking and considering that. Or if they're not actually mentally that well, then what can they do to get their confidence back? What can they do? You know, and that might be literally referring them to a therapist, or they might, you know, want to try some new things in some spare time, or they might want to go down to part time, or they might want to take a sabbatical. You know, if the organization does that kind of thing, because I think sometimes when you're so stuck in it, you can't actually see the wood for the trees, and you need to just step a little bit out, see what's out there, and then you can decide what you're going to do.
Gives you a little bit of different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's, yeah. And it's kind of like, and you've got a way up, you know, if I don't do this, what am I going to be like?
I really like that, because I think people associate the word something's risky with an action, but inaction at times, you know, well, inaction always carries a risk, and there are times where the risk of inaction is greater than the risk of actually taking an action and doing something.
Absolutely. I think it's like, what is your life going to be like if you carry on like this? Are you going to get more mentally unwell, you know?
Play the tape to the end. How does the story finish?
You know, okay, you're retiring in this amount of time. Can you last that long? You know, that's the other thing. You know, sometimes with people that have been in a career for a long time, they've, you know, how can they last another, you know, 5-10 years till the end of that career? Can they? But then you would start looking at options. Is there a way they can get their pension early, or, you know, you just have to explore
the things that
everything
these people never think of, because they're and I include myself in that, you know, you're down in the trenches of a problem or a situation, and it can be very hard to see what the options are.
And the other thing is letting go of some of the things that we are told are important. So money, if I leave this job, I'm not going to be able to afford my £500 a month car or my, you know, Sky TV sports edition, or, you know, it's like, okay, what is more important, your £500 a month car or your mental health and your happiness and your peace? Happiness is a funny word, I don't like it, but peace, you know, with yourself. And you hear about people doing it a lot, don't you? And they kind of leave these jobs and they sacrifice their money, financial stuff. They maybe downsize their house, all these kind of things, but they're much happier. They're feeling much better with themselves. Yeah. So,
and I would imagine that a barrier to making some of those decisions can be identity. Because some people are really good at it, some aren't, and some people, they exchange kind of it for a real identity of themselves. They go, but I must be successful because I have the house and I have the car and I have the job. Mm. Therefore, so you take all those things away and I'm no longer me, or even worse, I don't know who I am.
Yeah. And that's what we work in organizations with a lot, because you get the people that feel that their identity is very much connected, not just to the money, but to their level and hierarchical position in a company. And therefore, they always have to be the one in control, in authority, telling other people what they got to do. You know, that real old school authoritarian kind of approach. And actually, leaders now, that is the opposite of what you really need. We want humility. We want people that can empathize and connect and facilitate rather than, you know, ordering people around. And, you know, and it's quite interesting when you need people to let go of that status, to let go of the hierarchical position, to then be good leaders quite often. And a lot of the emotional intelligence stuff is connected into that.
Okay, so I mean, you're speaking to the converted, because I agree with what you're saying, but is there any data there to show, is there any evidence to show that organizations that embrace this new way of organizing themselves and running, you know, having leaders with humility and who are connected to their emotions and all of that, that they perform any better than organizations who follow this old traditional hierarchical way of doing business?
Well, there is. So from an emotional intelligence perspective, there's some real clear stats, and I'm going to probably get this slightly wrong, but bear with me. It's something like the most 90% of the top performing leaders in an organization have high emotional intelligence. And that people who are trained in emotional intelligence, and bearing in mind that encompasses a whole lot of these kind of behaviors, are, you know, if they can bring in more, they're more productive, they're bringing in more profit into an organization from a sales point of view. There's a report that I have that JCA did a few years ago on sales teams and emotional intelligence. So there's a lot of, there is data out there, and it's something like most of the qualities and the skills that leaders now need, a big percentage of those are emotional intelligence related.
Okay.
And anecdotally, you know, I can think of, if you think of the leaders that you've had, everyone thinks of them, and you think of the ones that you were most productive with and you enjoyed work most with and you were less likely to leave with, they're probably the ones that are much more emotionally intelligent and got you, understood you, thought about you, didn't put themselves into some kind of ridiculous pedestal where they are God. You know, they're much more
100%. There's one guy I'm thinking about in particular, and he's doing incredibly well in his organization now. And he was in a senior position when I was there, and he's even in an even more senior position now. And any business unit that was struggling, he got moved and put into that to fix it, essentially. And I can totally see why. Just for people who might not be familiar, when you say emotional intelligence, what are you actually talking about?
So there's lots of kind of definitions of emotional intelligence. The one that I use, which kind of comes from the profiling that I do, is that it's to do with the process of thinking about how you're feeling in order to alter your behavior. And therefore that impacts on your relationships. So, so if we think about, an instance where you're at work and you're typing away and you're busy doing a report and someone comes over to you and they come over and they interrupt you. Now, you may be irritated, okay? And if you were not very emotionally intelligent, you might turn around, tell them to F off and be quite rude because they've interrupted you in the middle of your thing. However, if you were more emotionally intelligent, you would recognize you're irritated. And this all happens kind of quite unconsciously for a lot of people as well. But sometimes we have to think about it and process it through consciously. You go, okay, I'm irritated. This person is interrupting me. Take a deep breath. And you go, okay, I'm irritated. I'm just going to respond to them though. I also know that person is having a hard time with their job at the moment. So I'm going to turn around. I'm going to say to them assertively, please, can you come back in a bit? I'm in the middle of a report. I know you need some help and I'm really here to help you, but I just need a bit of time to finish this report. The difference, that is kind of very simple explanation. So,
yeah, but it is. But to me, that's the difference between reacting and responding.
Yeah, yeah. But what you're doing is you're thinking about how you're feeling. You're not ignoring that feeling of irritation.
You're not suppressing that and saying, I need to be somebody else. You're actually going, okay, I'm really pissed off with this person. But you know what? Just take a beat. Have a think about it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really... It encompasses lots of different elements. So you've got, things like... emotional resilience. You've got, I've got to try and remember them all, some of them now. So two of the key ones are regard for yourself and regard for others. And this comes back to your trauma thing at the very beginning. So if you've had a lot of trauma, then your regard for yourself is likely to be quite low. Okay. So that means that your self-esteem is lower, your confidence is lower. So when somebody does something to you, you may think it's your fault and you may take it on board as your fault. Whereas somebody with higher self-regard, they may think, well, it's not my fault. It's not their fault. Let's try and figure this out. You know, so you're feeling more steady within yourself. And so, and also regard for others is about how you see other people, separate to the mistakes they make. So somebody with a high regard for others might see somebody in prison who's, you know, made mistakes and think, well, do you know what? They probably had a lot of issues in their life to get them to that point. So therefore I can empathize and understand why they might have ended up there. You know, I don't agree with what they've done, but I can understand.
You can see the person behind the actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same for yourself. If you've got high regard for yourself, then you can see you behind the mistakes that you might make, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got low, you'll be beating yourself up and go, oh, I'm such a loser. So it's those two have really pivotal roles in how somebody's emotional intelligence really works, and how it works for them. Because if those two are low, if somebody's got low regard for others, you can imagine that they're quite critical of others and they don't respect them and they think they're an idiot when they make a mistake. And how could you do that? You just loser, you know. So these have real big impacts. And then you've got the awareness, self-awareness. Are you aware of your emotions? Are you not aware of your emotions? Are you aware of other people's emotions? Are you not? So those play a part too. There's lots of aspects. I mean, in the profiling I do, there's about 16 aspects that are measured, and they, you can kind of see which bits are lower and which bits are higher. So, yeah.
It's because it's interesting. If you, I'm generalizing here now, I'm not thinking of any particular situation or organization, but you came to an organization with a piece of software or technology that could improve productivity with the sort of numbers that you can get out of having leaders that are emotionally intelligent, or I'm thinking here some of the work that Peter and Rosemary do with workplace innovation and some of the feedback they've had from organizations of, you know, bottom line increasing, you know, profitability of like 60% and stuff like that. You know, these are really, really big numbers. But because it's coming from a, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but, you know, some people think it's an airy-fairy sort of touchy-feely thing as opposed to a new piece of software or a new box in the corner that does some sort of electronic magic. It's a hard sell. But in reality,
it is.
In reality, the impact that this stuff can have if it's done right is huge.
Yeah. And for me as well, when I work with people, it's not just the impact on their work life, it's the impact on their home life. Lots of people will say that it's really changed the way they are at home as well. So it's across the board, you know. But like you say, people just think, oh, I'm not going to spend that money on doing that. I'm not going to spend that money on coaching or emotional intelligence profiling or any of the these kind of other things, because they just think it's, it's not going to make that much difference. Or I think they're scared of it. I think maybe protectors come in again.
I think as well, it's a bit like, how do you sell it to the board? Right? Everyone's got a boss, you know, how do I package this and sell it to the board if you haven't got people who are going to be receptive? Just to clarify, seeing as, you know, we're on a podcast. So Peter and Rosemary are directors of a company called Workplace Innovation, of which I am a non-executive director as well. And Natalie, you do some work for them too.
And they do
some really great stuff around this, and about the innovation part is innovating how workplaces actually function and how people operate in those workplaces. And it's all about, you know, if you make people, for want of a better phrase, and you're right, maybe it's not the best way of putting it, but if you make people happy in the workplace, then in general, productivity goes up, absenteeism goes down, levels of innovation go up. There's a real big correlation between, you know, people who enjoy coming to their workplace and good work and profitable work being done in those places.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it makes such a difference. And actually going back to the board and trying to convince the board, I think the board are the first people that should be doing any emotional intelligence profiling before you start, because if they're not connected into it and they don't know what it is,
never going to happen,
then you will have no chance. You know, the amount of innovation work that I've done over the years and with companies and things, if the leaders are not on board with it and totally get it, then it's really, you might get small pockets of stuff that works or teams that work if you've got a good leader in that team, but ultimately those people will leave because they're like, well, I can't be in this company if I've got these leaders that aren't supporting me.
I find it really interesting that some of the organizations that they work with and that this works really well is organizations that started out as small organizations and they've grown. And there's like a crisis of success within these organizations because the people at the top are kind of doing what they've always done because that's what got them to where they are. Yeah. But they can't anymore because they now have 200 people working underneath them and they've got to change. And it's the people who kind of wake up one morning and realize, I've got to do a complete step change here. And then they happen to find Peter and Rosemary, and you put that together and you've seen some, they've had some great successes. They really have, you know.
Yeah.
So.
And it takes somebody who's got a certain amount of emotional intelligence, I think, to notice that.
Yeah.
To notice that they need to change, that they don't have the answers. Because let's face it, no one person does have all the answers.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, maybe that's, I mean, I think of myself, through my career and being a leader, you can, it's an easy mistake to make in the beginning that you correlate being a leader to being the guy who's got all the answers. And that's not what a leader is. But, you know, when you're early in your career and you're young and you're, and somebody goes, okay, you're in charge of this. It's like, okay, I have to have all the answers. And that's not what it is at all.
Yeah. It really isn't, because, no. You know, how can you? And I think that connects into that status thing again, doesn't it? Is I need to be seen to know everything and be more important.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's interesting. As we come into the kind of the last 20 minutes or so of our conversation, let's go for another big kind of wide angle lens question about the state of mental health today. So not one is the state of it, and the other one is the perception of it, because I think there's been great strides made in the last 5 to 10 years with regards to the perception of it. It's become a much more everyday conversation now than it would have been, say, a decade ago, and certainly we say more than 20 years ago. But at the same time, I think the pressures on people, the pressures are different. We've gone from, although there are many people in really tough financial and living situations, but we've gone from, you know, large proportions of the population struggling to kind of survive from week to week. I mean, I think back to my great-grandparents' generation, my grandparents' generation, listening to them or listening to stories that my father would have told about, you know, his early years growing up in 1950s Ireland. And I always remember a great story about people kind of bemoaning the way the world was now. And it was like, oh, you know, back in the day, we could leave our door open and nothing ever got stolen, you know. And he'd say to me, yeah, because we didn't have anything to steal, you know. So, like, we've gone, as a larger proportion of the population are kind of more secure with a, you know, roof over their head, and they're going to have a meal that day, and there's plenty that don't. But the pressures now seem to be, they're coming from different places. I mean, social media gets a bad rap all the time, and that's probably not incorrect. There's an epidemic now of mental health issues, but is that because we talk about it more and we're willing to actually recognize and call things out for what they are, or is it actually that things have gotten worse?
I feel like it's both, actually. Okay. I think that we do talk about it more. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were talking about their grandparents, and they were saying how they, you know, they know their granddad had PTSD from the war and things, and but he would never talk about it, but he would be quite blank and, you know, not connecting and not emotionally there, and, you know, so I think that I think after the war, we had a huge amount of trauma that was never addressed because it was never even thought about. So I think that that has led on to then generations after that having difficult traumas themselves because of the interaction or the lack of interaction with their parents. And probably, you know, so I think that there is a sense now that we are noticing people like this now who have had traumas. I mean, I know there's still a big chunk of people who would never even go near their trauma and never experience it. But there's a lot more people in that area that we would notice people who had PTSD or had these things. And it was that stiff upper lip thing, wasn't it? You just get on with it and you just block it all off. So you put in as many protectors as you can and you just move forward, you know, which I see an awful lot too. But then I do think, I mean, the last 2 years or 18 months have been atrocious for trauma. I think we are all traumatized in small ways or big ways by the last 18 months. And whatever end of the COVID spectrum you are on, as far as, you know, fear or not fear or anything, there was still the restrictions that were put in place were traumatic for many people. I know from my own experiences and from what I've heard that those restrictions were horrendous. And the government has just, sorry, I'm going to get on.
Go for it, Glenn. Get up on your soapbox.
The government have just ignored that.
Okay.
And they're not dealing with it now. I know that children in schools who have now got serious OCD and parents going in asking for help and they're not getting it. And the teachers are saying, we don't know what to do. We've got tons of children with this. You know, we've got child abuse skyrocketed through this period of time. You know, you might have had a parent who maybe drank a bit, but not heavily, but during lockdown drank more and therefore ended up doing stupid, hideous stuff, you know. So you've then got the knock-on effects of those kind of things. And for generations, we are going to be dealing with those lockdowns for generations, generations. And there will be deaths for generations from, I mean, we had, personally, we had two friends who killed themselves during lockdown, the first lockdown. But those things were never shown, you know, and it makes me incredibly angry because clients that I had that were doing really well, completely gone backwards. And that's not, that's still a problem, you know, because we've also been in this COVID stasis for 18 months where we've been stuck, you know, not able to move forward. And I've noticed that in the UK, I don't know, it's a bit stricter in different countries, I know, but in the UK, we've been, our stuff has relaxed a bit. So we've been able to do more things. And as people come out into doing more things, it's harder because it's like any feelings that they might have had have been kind of held, you know, and now they're coming out and all these realities of life are coming back in and it's overwhelming for them because it's like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what to do. Or grief that has been held back because they were at home all the time. So it was kind of protecting them in some way, you know, and the reality of that person not being around anymore is really hitting them. And
yeah, I also think that people, just because of the nature of, you know, for open societies, and we're not used to being restricted like that, I think it triggers, your brain goes into survival mode because you don't know, there's this thing out there that's killing people. You don't really understand what it is. You can't do the things that you normally do when you're kind of, you know, going for a walk or whatever the things that you normally do. And you drop into kind of survival mode and it's about, I need to get through this. So now we're starting to come out the other side of that. And people, as you said, they've got this bank of emotions which they just stuck in the corner subconsciously because they're just trying to survive and get through whatever the hell is going on and get out to get the other side of it. And now they have, I mean, my situation, again, kind of trauma with a small T, but you know, it's funny, I'll off the back of the conversation we just had, I'm conscious about how I'm going to phrase this, but you know, people have had it worse than me, but but no, genuinely, yeah. Like my sister had a baby in the middle of all this and I missed it all. I never got to see her pregnant and the baby was like 8 months before I met the baby. And again, you know, people have lost loved ones, people have lost jobs, you know, there's a lot of people out there hurting in a lot of ways. But for me, to miss all of that, not be part of it with my family, it was a little bit traumatic. And I didn't really kind of realize that until I went to Ireland and I kind of closed that loop. And I saw my family and I met the baby for the first time. And it's only kind of when I actually got to the back end of that process that I realized the impact.
Tell me what to do. And and I don't want to do what I'm being told what to do. So, yeah, you know, yeah. So no, it's been
challenging and it's going to be, I think from a societal point of view, I think it's our generations, it's our equivalent of a world war. You know, that's this big major global event that has completely upended how we live.
Yeah, it will. Yeah. And I think, you know, it is going to go on for generations. It is. We're going to
There's an interesting one, or it's something that I've learned a little bit about, and for most people, it would be, we'd say, so generational trauma. So trauma that is essentially handed down from generation to generation. So I'm of the age, you know, my parents were born in the late 40s. My wife's parents were born in the early 50s. They're German, so they were born into, you know, early 1950s East Germany. My parents were born into the late 40s, Ireland, Ireland went independent or free state in 1922. You roll out of, you know, basically trying to create a new country or a new state out of nothing, and you roll into being on the edges of one of probably the greatest conflict in world history. And then you've got to try and build a country and an economy coming off the back end of that. And, you know, go back even further, and you've got, you know, the Great Famine, the 1840s and 50s in Ireland. I used to say things like, it kind of stains the land, but I suppose it's not the land really, it's actually the people. It's a mark on the people. And you think something, well, it's 150 years ago, that doesn't matter. But I'm not so sure. I think how a people live their lives and interact, and this sort of trauma, particularly when it's not been processed, it impacts people. And you don't realise it, but the way you look at the world and the way you interact with the world, you generally tend to learn that from your parents, and they learned it from their parents, and they learned it from their parents. And these things get handed down generation upon generation.
Yeah, and I see it so much. And actually, I kind of like to remind people that come and see me in a therapeutic sense that you're trying to break that pattern. You're breaking that generational pattern. And, you know, and people... when we're talking about the shame behind going to see a therapist or someone like that, you know, for me, I was in therapy for many years, way past the time that I needed to be in it. But for me, it was a lifestyle choice as well, because I just needed that space to explore things that were coming up, and for somebody to remind me how that linked back to that. And, you know, and that was really helpful. And I think that, that it's really important that people see it as a choice rather than a kind of when they get really bad, they have to go. You know, it's almost like go earlier and see it as you trying to break those patterns that you had previously been put on, the trauma you'd had put onto you. That's probably been through probably several generations. And, you know, and yes, okay, you may be coping with it, okay. And actually, that's probably a good time to go, because you're in a place where somebody can really work with you. Whereas if you come and see a therapist when it gets to the point where you're literally signed off work, not being able to work, or, you know, or you're really in a place where you're reliving trauma or something, there's a lot of work that needs to go in before you can start exploring things properly. Because you've got to stabilize. Yeah.
I mean, I look upon it. I mean, I use the example, I've had a coach on and off for 16, 17 years now. And even in the early days, when kind of it wasn't a very well known or understood thing. And I used to say to people, you know, the best golf player in the world will have a swing coach, or you'll have a tennis player will have, you know, a top tennis player will have a number of coaches, some of them specializing in different things. He'll have a physiotherapist, he'll have a dietitian, I used to look upon it as it was another person of my coaching staff, if you will, that worked with me as and when required to make my performance better, to improve what I was doing. I mean, particularly around times when I was considering moving roles, or I was getting that feeling of I'm not particularly happy doing what I'm doing. It was, all right, time to engage with the coach, speak to him or her. Let's do an assessment. What's really going on here? Because sometimes If you're trying to solve the wrong problem, that's going to make things worse. Yeah. So it's like, what's really going on here? And sometimes it was like, yeah, you need to move role. Another time it was like, no, you've got something else going on in your life that you need to look at, not changing jobs. So I would always say I would be a great supporter of reaching out, finding help early. And it can take a number of different guises. You know, it could be start with a coach, somebody that you like and you get on with. And you may find that you need to go further and you might need to go somebody who's a bit more qualified. But thinking that you got to do everything yourself, you're putting yourself in a tough corner to start with.
Yeah. And it's that thing. So one of the emotional intelligence aspects is reflective learning. And I think this is something in organizations, you often hear it spoken about, that growth mindset as well, you know, where you want to develop. And you want to keep developing. And if you kind of come at life with that, then you will be seeking out those opportunities. You'll also be the leader that goes, oh, there's something wrong. I can't do it anymore. I need to get help. Or, you know, or the person that's just struggling a bit and just thinks there's something going on. I need some help, you know. But that growth mindset, and I think, I don't know how I got it. I can't really recall how I got it, but I think I did get that quite early. I love learning things. I love new things. I love exploring myself and what I'm doing. And, you know, and I think that kind of mindset or reflective learning, reflecting on how you're doing, your emotions, what's going on, and then learning from that and taking it forward is quite often, you know, a really good place to start. And from an emotional intelligence perspective, it's a fundamental thing. If you don't have somebody who's not willing to do that, then it's very hard to work with them.
Yeah. And I would encourage anybody who's listening to this, who's sometimes the terminology can put people off. I know, for example, anytime mindfulness gets mentioned around my wife, there is an audible eye roll.
Yes, I know. Do you know, it's been papered in though, hasn't it? It's been like people sort of say, oh, you've got to do this mindfulness thing, or you've got to do this, or you've got to do that. But the thing is it's almost like papering over the cracks.
I always remember this quote from an article in the FT about 3 or 4 years ago now at this stage, and it was about mindfulness in the workplace. And it was a take on kind of the current situation of mental health in the UK workplace, you know, and it was a summary of this person's view on it. And then they brought in mindfulness, and mindfulness courses, we'd say, within an organization is the equivalent of breaking people's legs between 9 and 5. And then at lunchtime, teaching them how to make splints.
It totally is. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's it can be useful. It can be, I think, if done right. And I think it's almost more of a mindset and an outlook rather than an activity. But I think it can be very useful. But it's become this catch-all throwaway phrase for like magic fairy dust, and it's going to make everything okay.
I know, it's really the same as resilience training as well. You know, they do a lot of resilience training now. So you can be more resilient against the stuff that they make you do.
So. Well, my favorite story from a friend of mine in the UK, an organization, was there was some upward feedback to the senior leadership team about essentially, could you, like, you're driving us crazy. Like you're changing your mind all the time. You're asking us to do this, 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 and this, and this. So they brought in like a facilitator to kind of facilitate a conversation between the middle managers and the senior leadership team and all of this. And the report came back, and the senior leadership team reported back that their take on it was that the people below them weren't resilient enough.
Oh,
I was like, oh, really? Really? Okay. So, yeah. There's a lot of work to be done out there in certain organizations.
There's a few protectors going on in that, isn't there?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Listen, wow. Natalie, it's been really interesting to talk with you. It's been great to chat, and we've touched on some really interesting topics.
Thank you for asking me to do it.
Do you want to do a little pitch for Elephants in the Room?
So Elephants in the Room is my business, where I do similar things to what we've spoken about, really, around leadership coaching and profiling and workshops. And I do creative facilitation around processes of getting, it's like brainstorm processes, but entirely different. It's really about getting ideas and creativity and information, but in a really structured way. So I do those kind of things too, and generally just supporting teams that might be struggling or individuals in that respect. So,
and the website is
elephantsintheroom.co.uk. But remember the S on elephants, because everyone gets my email wrong and forgets.
There is more than one elephant in the room.
Yeah, exactly. There's loads of them. Let's face it.
Yeah, there really is. Okay, Natalie, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for talking to me.
Thank you, Shane. Thank you.